Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Happy Mardi Gras and welcome to Catholic Answers Live, in case you have not been paying attention. The Lenten fast begins tomorrow with Ash Wednesday. Perhaps we could help you prepare for Lent by answering any questions you might have about the Catholic faith. We've got 2 hours of open forum today, one-stop shopping for whatever you would like to discuss about the Catholic faith. I am your host, Cy Kellett, and the lines fill up fast, so give us a call now at 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. Before we get to open forum, however, as you plan for Lent, may I suggest some spiritual reading, maybe a half hour or hour each day of reading, maybe 15 minutes reading in the Bible or some other spiritually uplifting writing. You could even include Catholic Answers magazine in your reading list. And conveniently, a new issue is out tomorrow. Tim Ryland, editor of Catholic Answers magazine, is here to discuss the new issue. Hi, Tim.
Cy, thanks for having me.
And so the new issue's out, and I see Mr. Horn is on the cover. Trent Horn is on the cover.
Yeah, we usually have older saints on the cover, but we just happen to go modern day this time.
A living saint, Trent Horn.
That's right.
And maybe James White, too. We don't know. No? Okay, we do know. Okay, you're willing to say with confidence. So James White is he's a Calvinist.
Yes, he's a Reformed evangelical is how I usually hear him described.
Okay, and he and Trent had a debate about the whether or not once saved, always saved.
That's right, whether or not Christians can lose their salvation. That was in late January, and we have a very truncated transcript of it, but I think a very fair transcript of the debate between the two. That took place. That's our cover story.
And so then you have another story that kind of goes, at least I thought it kind of goes with it, from Jimmy Akin.
Yes, that's right. Jimmy wrote something. We ran it in tandem, and it covers some of the same types of issues, but I think it fills in some of the gaps, talking about why we can lose our salvation and how that can happen, as opposed to people that James White say, there are certain Christians that are just plain saved. And they can't lose that salvation. And there are the Christians that simply aren't saved, no matter what they do. So we're giving the Catholic side of things.
Well, we agree with that. It's just not in this world.
That's
the ones
right.
in heaven are saved for,
that's
for
right.
all time.
Yeah, mincing words here. But
yeah.
That's right.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Did I mince? A couple of articles struck me. One on who wrote the Golden Rule. Mm-hmm. Or who came up with the Golden Rule.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is kind of a thing. I don't know if you would say it's a canard, but it's kind of a thing that people will, Christianity's not that original.
That's right.
Because everybody's got the Golden Rule.
Right.
So give us a little on
that. Sean McAfee has written an article basically starting off with that, as you call it, a canard, saying that Christianity just isn't the cynosure because it's just saying the same thing that people have said throughout history, excuse me, through all kinds of different traditions and religions, and he points out that it's part of the moral law actually, and it's more of a rule of how to love rather than what to do, and when you base it in Catholic theology, and I think it's a very interesting article, very interesting take on it.
I know that people are like, well, how do I get this magazine? Just go to Catholic.com/magazine, Catholic.com/magazine.
That's right, you'll see
and you can get it. I haven't read Carlo's article yet. I see a tree. You see a tree. I see God,
mm-hmm.
and so. Should I just ask Carlo about it or should I read it? I should probably read it.
You should probably ask him.
Okay, so no, but what is, because I haven't gotten to that one yet. What's that piece about?
It's a very philosophical take on the idea that not only are all created things reliant upon God to create them, but for every instant of their being, of our being, we're reliant on the divine will just to exist. If God quit loving us or quit willing our existence, we would just kind of disappear with a poof. So it's a very interesting philosophical argument that he's talking about causal connections and causal chains, and how we live from second to second through God's will.
And I maybe my favorite article, but I just love history stuff. And Carl's article on the Spanish Civil War.
That's right.
Between the nationalists and the now I'm forgetting the other side. Well, whatever. So basically, it's a Catholic story in large part because Carl tells it in a really interesting way.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, Spain was such a Catholic country and then it and then it fell into – that's not what happened.
Yeah,
and I love the way Carl addresses that.
Yeah, as Carl points out, at that point in the 20th century, it was very much Catholic in name only. It was very much secularized at the time of the Civil War. So it wasn't just the black and white Catholics versus nationalists, et cetera. So –
And Tim Ryland, what's coming up in future? So we Catholic Answers Magazine bi-monthly, or is that how you say it?
Bi-monthly.
Every
six,
other month.
Yeah, six times a year.
Yeah, six times a year.
Right.
Okay, so the debate over eternal security is this month, March, or this 2 months,
this
March,
is
April.
March, April issue, which will actually be hitting people's mailboxes within the next week or so.
And then what comes up after that, like May,
well,
June?
Well, May, June, we're having – May is the 100th anniversary of the apparition of Fatima to the three children. So we have a Fatima-themed issue, a Fatima at 100 years, a couple of interesting articles about that, like how do we look at Fatima after 100 years, and also an interesting article by one of our apologists, Michelle Arnold, about exploding some of the myths that you hear around Fatima.
Oh, very cool.
For instance, like the consecration was never done, that type of thing. So then, and also one more big piece for us will be September, October, which will mark September, October, the 500th anniversary of the 95 Theses, the Reformation. So we'll have an entire issue themed around the Reformation, articles like Mark Brumley's writing on why the Reformation was necessary but Protestantism wasn't. So that type of thing.
Oh, I got to read that.
Yeah, no, we've got some
that
good stuff lined
up. That sounds good. Okay, so you go to catholic.com/magazine
That's
to
right.
get it.
And on the left-hand side, you'll see a subscribe button that you can click on.
Yeah, you do a great job, Tim.
Well, everybody here does a great job.
You look at you. Very, very so Catholic.
Happy to be
man.
Part of it.
But it's a beautiful magazine. Get it now. The debate over eternal security with Trent Horn and James White is on the cover this time. Next time, Fatima. After that, the Reformation. And who knows? Just
maybe Cy Kellett.
Yeah. Okay, that'll be good.
Hopefully, that'll be a good issue.
The scandal. Once the scandal comes out, you can cover that. Thanks, Tim.
All right. Thank you, Cy.
And open forum today on Catholic Answers Live, the number to call with any question you've got about the Catholic faith, whether you are Catholic or not, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour is Catholic apologist and speaker Jim Blackburn. And Jim, as you probably know, has a long association with Catholic Answers. And in addition to his book, 101 Quick Questions with Catholic Answers, Marriage, Divorce, and Annulment, he is also the author of 10% of the Catholic Answers 20 Answers books. He wrote 20 Answers Scripture and Tradition and 20 Answers the Papacy. Welcome, Jim Blackburn. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Cy. Always great to be here with you.
And
by the way, I'm also the author of 20 Answers Divorce and Remarriage. So is that 15% of them?
Oh my gosh, you're up to 15%. Nice going. Uh-huh. Nice work. I don't know how I missed that.
Thank
one.
You.
Sorry.
Right.
So I haven't gotten to it yet. That's why I missed it. Jim, do you celebrate Mardi Gras? Is that like a thing for you?
Fat Tuesday. You know, it's kind of the last day.
What'd you call me?
before Lent begins. And so, not in a real big way like the French do, but certainly it's that last day before we begin the very holy penitential season of Lent. And so it's kind of marks a special day, I guess.
Yeah. I have my best friend Drew and I, I don't know, 30 years or something, we've celebrated by having a chocolate donut on Mardi Gras because
no
donuts after that for a good long while. And that's the saddest thing to not
donuts. I think we're going to go out for pizza tonight just to
party. Well, throw a chocolate donut in at the end. That makes for a real Mardi Gras. I'm telling you.
Sounds
right
good.
Now.
I'll try that.
Okay. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Our guest, Jim Blackburn, happy to take your questions on any aspect of the life or faith of the Catholic Church. Lines are already filling up. So I do suggest that if you've got questions for Jim on any aspect of the Catholic faith, 888-318-7884, dial that now. If it's all right with you, we'll take a quick break and then we'll come back, Jim, with Jason in Los Alamitos with his question on open forum.
Sounds good.
We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.
Don't you just love listening to Jim Blackburn? Did you know you can book Jim or any of our other great speakers to speak at your parish or special event? Contact one of our seminar coordinators through the Speakers Bureau section on Catholic.com today to find out more information. What is the Catholic form of marriage and why is it important? What factors may invalidate a marriage? What about the so-called exception clause for divorce in cases of adultery? In 20 Answers, Divorce and Remarriage, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, helping you understand church teaching on the indissolubility of marriage while examining the pastoral and canonical realities for Catholics who wish to join together in marriage. 20 Answers Divorce and Remarriage is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Mark 10:28, Peter began to say to Jesus, "What about us? We have given up everything and followed you." Jesus acknowledged that no one who has given up house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or lands for his sake and for the sake of the gospel will not receive 100 times more in the present age, plus persecutions and eternal life in the age to come. To give up all in order to have him in this life will mean having the consolation of his favor, but it will include the cross. For the apostles, except for John, it was to include martyrdom. For us, it means enduring the crosses that each one of us has. So what are we going to get for following him? We will have him. The better we know him, the more we understand that he is more than enough. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
I should have worn my beads today. I'm not wearing any beads. Mardi Gras
beads. You're
supposed to wear your Mardi Gras beads. I've never been to a – oh, yeah, I have been to a big Mardi Gras thing one time. All right. Jim Blackburn is our guest this hour. Our topic, open forum. That means you pick the topic. Essentially, you anything, any question you've got on the life or faith of the Catholic Church. We go now, Jim Blackburn, to Jason in Los Alamitos, California, listening on AM 930, the mighty KHJ. Jason, you are on with Jim.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Jason.
So I was raised Catholic, was taken away from the church, became Protestant, vehemently Protestant for years and years and years. God saved me back to the Catholic Church through my wife and through many friends. So my point is I believe all of what the church says very, very strongly. I wouldn't question it. And so my question is, I know the Eucharist, when it becomes the Eucharist, when the bread becomes the body, it is all Jesus. I know that. It's not consubstantiation, it's trans. And I get that. However, my question is, my son has gluten allergies, and when he takes the host, the Eucharist, he gets really, really sick. So how do I explain that to my Protestant friends when they come at me? My answer is obviously just like with the wine, if you drink a lot of it, you can get drunk. So right. It's the same answer I give them for the Eucharist, but I'm looking for something deeper.
Okay, Jason, great question. The ancient philosophers, the ancient Greek philosophers, when they discussed the essence of what something is, they differentiated between the accidents of what something is and its essence. The accidents being, you know, maybe the what it looks like to us, how our senses respond to it, what it looks like, tastes like, feels like, smells like, these types of things. The essence of something, though, is what it truly is. Now, that might sound a bit confusing, but an example that sometimes is used is, say, we have cloth that is sewn into a certain pattern, and say denim, and make a pair of pants out of it. You've got a pair of jeans. Well, if you unstitch that those jeans and make a shirt out of it, then the essence of what you have has changed. The accidents are the same, but the essence has changed. It's changed. It's no longer a pair of pants. It's now a shirt. That's a very crude example of how you can have accidents remain the same, but the essence of something change. You mentioned the term transubstantiation. This is a term that the church does use, has used since the Middle Ages, to explain this phenomenon, what happens in the Eucharist when the accidents remain the same, the essence, the substance is changed. That transubstantiation, change in substance, is what actually occurs at the consecration. So our senses are going to continue to respond to the accidents in the way that our bodies would otherwise. If that was still a piece of bread, that's how our bodies are going to respond to it. If it's still a glass of wine, we can still get drunk. But we know that the essence, the substance of what this is, has actually changed. It is the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Christ. So I have a niece who has celiac disease, and so she cannot receive the Eucharist under the form of bread either. But she can receive from the cups, from the chalice. She can receive the blood of Christ. And the church has been very adamant to explain, in fact, during the Council of Trent, this is something that came up, that when you receive Christ in the Eucharist, whether it's under bread alone or under wine alone or both, you're receiving the fullness of the Eucharist. You're receiving the body, blood, soul, and divinity in its fullness. So what you might do is have your son receive from the chalice, but not receive under the form of bread. Does that make sense, Jason?
Yes, and I've mentioned the accidents argument with them, and they still come back with, well, you know, then you're saying it's not all Jesus. And I say, yeah, you're right. It's not all Jesus. It's the substance. It's the essence is still Jesus, but there's accidental substances with it. And I don't know. It goes back
it's
and
still,
forth.
Well, no, you can say it is still completely Jesus, just like, and again, I know it's a crude example, but just like a pair of jeans, that's completely a pair of jeans. That's fully a pair of jeans. Or when it's unstitched, stitched another way, that's completely a shirt. You cannot say it's not a shirt. It fully is a shirt, full essence of a shirt. And there are other examples we could come up with. But so you might try, Jason, in fact, go to Catholic.com. I know there are other examples that are used there. Type in accidents and an explanation of accidents, and you might find some more examples that would be helpful. But ultimately, it comes down to understanding that what is happening is a change of the substance without a change in the accidents. All right.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks very much. 888-318-7884 is the number. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. We go now to Rosie in El Paso, Texas, listening on EWTN. Oh, no, listening to EWTN on Roku. And I didn't even know you could do that. Rosie, you are on with Jim Blackburn.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Rosie.
I have a question. I teach RCIA. And it wasn't a question before that when I had a catechumen and they didn't convalidate their marriage, they were married civilly, they had to take care of that first, or they would get their sacraments on the day that they convalidated their marriage. So now my question is, the new priest, I have a new priest at my parish, and he says no. He says that you are not supposed to turn away anybody from the sacraments of initiation, even if they have not convalidated their marriage, as long as they're serious about convalidating their marriage, even afterwards. So he could go ahead and get all three sacraments at this time. And I keep hearing around here that, from different priests, that the local the priest from each parish can decide for himself who can take communion and who cannot. And if this is true, I'd like for you to tell me where I could find this. What document? What has changed? Am I wrong? Is he wrong? What is going on?
Okay. Well, Rosie, you mentioned quite a bit of information there. I have a question for you, though. Are we talking about, you mentioned you are an RCIA teacher. Are we talking about catechumens? Are you sure we're talking about catechumens here?
Yes, because a catechumen. He needs to be baptized. He has never been baptized in any church.
Okay. Well, then there's been, I think, at least some sort of a misunderstanding or a miscommunication because, as I'm sure you know, baptism is oftentimes called the gateway to the sacraments. It is the sacrament that must be received before any of the other sacraments can be received. So until someone in your RCIA, until a catechumen, and that's what a catechumen is, someone who has not been baptized but is coming into the church. Until a catechumen has been baptized, he cannot validly or illicitly receive the other sacraments. So that's, that's fundamental Catholic doctrine right there. So I would approach, who was it that told you this? Was it your pastor that mentioned this?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Then I would take, this is serious enough of a concern that I would take this up the ladder, you know, call the bishop's office, or call the vicar for priests, someone to, at the diocesan level, to see if you can explain this to them, see if they can explain to you what's going on. And I suspect what has happened is that your pastor has misunderstood some sort of a directive from the bishop that might say something to the effect of, if you have someone who's approaching you for the sacraments, it's at your discretion whether you can administer the sacraments or not, presuming that this is a baptized Catholic that we're talking about. Because certainly I can't believe a bishop would, I'm certain that a bishop has not done what you've said and allowed priests to administer sacraments to the unbaptized, because it's not possible to administer the sacraments to the unbaptized. So I would take this up. I think there's been some miscommunication probably from between your pastor and wherever he received the instruction, and it's something that is a serious enough of a concern. I think the church would call this a grave issue, serious enough of a concern that it should be addressed. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rosie.
You're welcome.
We go to Alex in Los Angeles, California, listening on AM 930 Immaculate Heart Radio. Alex, you are on with Jim Blackburn. What's your question, please?
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, and I am a divorced man. I was married through the Catholic Church, and I guess I absented myself from church for a while, but I am back attending Mass, and I really want to take communion, and but I want to know, what are the procedures? Am I committing a sin? I mean, can I not get communion anymore?
Okay, Alex, you said you were married in the Catholic Church and you're divorced. Have you have you entered into another marriage, a subsequent marriage?
No, I'm single.
You're living as a single man now. Then
yes.
Your divorce of itself is not going to be an obstacle to receiving the sacraments. Now, it could be that your divorce was an occasion of sin for you. I don't know. You might talk to a spiritual director about that to determine if there's something there that you need to confess. And certainly, if you've been away from the church for a while, you need to talk to a spiritual director, and most likely you need to go to confession. In fact, we're obligated as Catholics to confess our serious sins, our mortal sins, once a year, at least at the very minimum. So if you've been away from the church for a while, I would recommend your first step be to make an appointment with your pastor or another priest in your parish, if there were others, and to make an appointment to go and sit down and have confession. I'd recommend, when you've been away from the church for a while, don't just go stand in the confession line on a Saturday afternoon and expect, you know, to sit down in the confessional and then hit the priest with all of this. I'd recommend that you make an appointment, go in and have confession that way. And then once the priest has absolved you of your sins, you should be free to then receive the Eucharist and the other sacraments as well as necessary. Sometimes people will confuse the idea or misunderstand the church's teaching that if you are divorced and then remarried outside the church and you're continuing to live in that state, that can be an obstacle to receiving communion, because you would basically be living in the state of adultery. But that's not your case. You're divorced. You're not living as a married man, and so you should be able to return to the sacraments, but that starts with confession. Okay.
Thanks so much, Alex. Perfect time for that question as we approach the Lenten season and Easter. It's wonderful, I'm sure, to know that the church is there and you can come receive the sacraments. 888-318-7884 is the number. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and our guest this hour is Jim Blackburn. It's open forum, so any question you've got on the life or faith of the church is more than welcome. We're happy to take it. We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Cardinal Francis Arinze, speaking to you through Catholic Answers Live. God bless you.
It may be true for you, but not for me. How often have you heard this during a discussion with friends or family? Whether talking about faith, morality, politics, or just the basic notion of truth, so many people are captive to the notion of relativism, the belief that reality is something we decide. In his new audio presentation, Your Truth, My Truth, apologist Carlo Broussard breaks down this intellectual cancer, looking at the different kinds of relativism we regularly encounter and demonstrating how, ultimately, they collapse under the weight of their own incoherence. More importantly, Carlo makes a powerful case for the existence of objective truth, showing you how to explain to others that right and wrong are both real and universal, because it was designed that way by God. Order your copy of Your Truth, My Truth by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
We as Catholics need to stand strong, to be prepared to mount a daily defense, to respond to the many challenges that we as believers are presented with every day. Jimmy Akin is here to help. His innovative new book, A Daily Defense, takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, 366 in all, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, with challenges and answers indexed alphabetically, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum this hour with Jim Blackburn. Jim is taking your calls on any aspect of the life or faith of the church, whether you're Catholic or non-Catholic. We more than welcome the questions of non-Catholics during this hour. Actually, I think probably any hour you can call if you're non-Catholic. 888-318-7884 is the number. Rosie in Whittier, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Rosie, you are on with Jim Blackburn. What's your question, please?
Hello, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Rosie. I am a catechist.
Can you hear me?
We can, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I'm a catechist for RCIA, and when I work with the neophytes. Questions about Lent, because I'll go over Lent and what it is. Some of the questions that I would like to answer with correct answers. Number one, why we don't eat meat on Friday. Previously, it was every Friday, and then now it's changed. Number two, the almsgiving and the things during Lent. That's basically my question.
Okay.
Why do we do it for Lent?
You cut out there right at the very end. You mentioned almsgiving. Oh. You mentioned not eating meat on Fridays. And what was the other one?
And I think it's the other prayer. Well, prayer, yeah, okay. I can figure that one out. But basically, why those things?
Okay, and this is, Rosie, a very timely time to be asking this question because tomorrow begins Lent, and Lent is a penitential season. It's primarily a penitential season. We're preparing for what happened on Good Friday, and then ultimately what happened on Lent ends on the Holy Thursday, just before Good Friday, and then we prepare for, in the Triduum, the resurrection on Easter Sunday. And then we have the Easter season, which is a very joyful, glorious season. But during a penitential season, in our preparation for the crucifixion of Christ, really, we're looking at that and see that the greatest sacrifice that has ever been made in the history of mankind happened on Good Friday, what Jesus did on the cross for us on Good Friday. And what he did is he sacrificed his life, and his life was a good life. He was a good man. He was a divine person, but he had a human nature. So he was a man in that sense, and he never sinned, and he did not deserve the punishment on the cross that he got. But he gave his life, a very good and wonderful thing, gave it for us so that our sins could be forgiven. And that's the type of penance that we try to do. Certainly, we can't rise to that level, but we can, in some small way, do something that would kind of reflect that. We can, during Lent, for example, we do not eat meat on Fridays. We give that up. Meat is a good thing, but we forego eating meat on the Fridays of Lent, as well as on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. On Ash Wednesday and Good Friday, we also fast. We eat less than we normally would. We make that sacrifice of a good thing, to in some way participate in the sacrifice that Christ made on Good Friday for us. So these are penitential acts. Almsgiving also. This is, you know, where we maybe donate money or food to the poor, to those who are less fortunate than us. These are good things that we do. We give something good to those who are in more need, greater need than we are. Another penitential act, prayer. We can enter into prayer, praying for others, praying for each other. This all comes together for us, and Lent is the perfect time to really focus on this aspect of our lives, the penitential aspect of our lives. Lent is a good time to go to confession as well, in preparation for Good Friday and then, of course, the resurrection and the Easter season. So, Rosie, I hope that helps and hope that will help you explain to your catechism class why we do these things, especially during Lent.
Aries in San Antonio, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Aries, you are on with Jim Blackburn. What's your question?
My question is, when we eat the Eucharist, how are we not cannibals?
Okay, Aries, great question. Can I ask how old you are, Aries?
I am 12.
12, okay. That's a great question, something for somebody your age to be thinking about. And I can tell you that this isn't something that is really an odd question. It's something that in the early church, the early Christians were actually accused of cannibalism because we're eating the body and blood of Jesus when we partake in the Eucharist. But if we correctly understand what cannibalism is, we can see that that's not really what's happening at all. In cannibalism, we will either as cannibalism exists around the world, even today, it ultimately would generally require the killing of someone in order to eat that person's flesh. You know, this is how in some third world countries cannibalism might happen today. But that's not what we're doing in the case of Jesus. Jesus gave us his body. He laid down his body for us, for the forgiveness of our sins. And then he commanded us to eat his flesh and drink his blood. In John chapter 6, he tells us to do that. But we're doing it in an unbloody way. You know, we receive the Eucharist in the form of bread and wine. It looks like food that we ordinarily would eat. And so we're consuming him in that way, consuming his flesh in that way. But it's we're not actually digesting it. Something that a lot of people don't realize is that once we receive the Eucharist and it's entered our stomach and our digestive system, once it loses the appearance of bread and wine and starts to dissolve into what it's made of, the accidents that it change and it no longer has the appearance of bread and wine, it's no longer at that point actually the body and blood of Christ. So the real presence of Christ actually leaves at that moment, at that point. So we're not going on then to digest Jesus and, you know, like we would if we were eating the flesh, body, and blood of another human being that we've killed to eat as food. So I hope that helps a little bit, Aries. It's a very unique thing that's happening in the Eucharist, and God himself has commanded us to do it. For our good, because it gives us life. It gives us the supernatural life that we receive from the sacrament. So it's a very good thing. All right, Aries?
We lost Aries, but...
Lost Aries, okay.
Yep, thanks so much. Jim, I think I'll... you know, we're on Facebook Live, YouTube Live, and Periscope now, and lots of folks send us questions via the kind of the little texting texting part of those applications. And so they're watching us on video, Jim. We probably should have told you that before the show began, that you're on video.
Oh, I'm on video.
Should I have mentioned that? Was that something you wanted to know?
Yeah, that's fine, thanks.
And I'm trying to look at them right now, and they keep moving, and I don't know what's going on my computer. I'm just going to pick one right now. Brandon on Facebook Live asked the following question, and I'm getting to Brandon only because that's where my document stopped on, Jim. Is singing during a Eucharistic exposition and benediction allowed? I am part of a young adult group that has monthly adoration. A few of them sing contemporary songs a few times during the hour in between exposition and benediction. Would this type of music be allowed if music is allowed?
Okay, great question. And my understanding, and I would have to really consult the religious texts on this, but there is a rite of benediction that takes place. There is during public exposition that, as long as those things are being followed, the rite of benediction and such, then my understanding is other things that can be added, such as community prayer. We could also, I believe, include community singing. Those types of things can be allowed as well. Oftentimes, exhibition of the Eucharist is something that can take place over a long period of time, hours or days in some cases. And to plan things during that time is something that I believe is built into this whole process. But I would have to check. If you go to your parish library, there will be a book, a two-volume book called The Rites, R-I-T-E-S, The Rites, Volume 1 and Volume 2. And in that two-volume set, you will find the rites of benediction and the procedures to follow during, this Eucharistic time. And consult that. And if you don't find your answer there, but I think you will, if you don't find your answer there, call me back either off the air, contact me through my Facebook page or through my Catholic Answers page. You can find me at Catholic.com or call the apologists at Catholic Answers, and I'm sure they could help you more with that.
888-318-7884 is the number. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Next hour, Tim Staples will be in here taking your questions. This hour, Jim Blackburn. And we've got a whole segment left, Jim, so don't leave us.
Okay.
And you're going to be on video for that one. We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
This is Tim Staples, and I'm challenging you to take the 20 Answers Challenge. Catholic Answers 20 Answers series offers hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world. Here's how the challenge works. When you purchase the sampler of all 20 books in the series, we're going to knock the price in half, and we're challenging you to finish them all this Lent and Easter season. Then we're going to take $10 from each set purchased and provide materials to our friends at St. Paul Street Evangelization so they can do what they do best, hit the streets and share the Catholic faith. That's $10 from every set you purchase going to help our fellow workers in the vineyard. You win, St. Paul Street Evangelization wins, the Catholic Church wins. That's a win-win-win. Together, we can be part of something great. Call 888-291-8000 or visit the shop at Catholic.com now to get your set and begin taking the 20 Answers Challenge today.
How can the Eucharist truly be Christ's body? Does belief in the real presence mean that Catholics are cannibals? Do the Bible and early Christians support Catholic teaching on the Eucharist? In 20 Answers, the Eucharist, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, helping you deepen your own appreciation for this most precious sign of Christ's enduring presence in the world. 20 Answers, the Eucharist is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
It is Open Forum today on Catholic Answers Live. I am your host, Cy Kellett. Our guest this hour, Jim Blackburn, apologist and speaker and author. And the number to call with your question about any aspect of Catholic faith and life is 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. And you don't have to be Catholic to call. We'll take any call at all. So we go now to Jay in Woodbridge, Virginia. Listening via Catholic.com. Jay, you are on with Jim Blackburn. Your question, please.
Hello. So my question revolves around this one aspect of The Godfather Part 3 that always bugged me, which is the fact that the Pope was killed in the movie. And I found out that it's actually based on a conspiracy theory of Pope John Paul I's death, which I think was like he was linked to some... The theory goes that he was linked to some kind of banking scandal in Italy. I don't buy that for a sec, but that just kind of makes me wonder, why did Pope John Paul I die in the first place so young?
Well, first of all, congratulations on making it all the way through The Godfather 3. I think you might be the only person who's done that. But Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, John Paul I died of a heart attack. I mean, he died in his sleep and in his bed, you know, just less than 30 days, I believe, after he was after he became the Pope. Because he died after such a short episcopacy, yeah, there are a lot of these conspiracy theories and you know, all kinds of things, stories came about. They've been debunked. I mean, it's his doctor came in the morning after he died, observed him, determined that he had died of sort of natural causes or a heart attack, as I think was the final determination that he just died of a heart attack. You can die of a heart attack of any age. So that's what happened to John Paul I. There isn't any legitimacy to the conspiracy theories that are out there. This it was just a tragic short episcopacy for him. But you know what? It ushered in John Paul II, which is God can make really good things come out of bad things. And that was a wonderful thing that occurred after his death. All right, Jay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jay. Nate in Dallas, Texas, listening on 910 AM Guadalupe Radio. You are on with Jim Blackburn.
Hi, gentlemen. Good afternoon. I was wondering if Mary being immaculately conceived meant that she was exempt from the curse of original sin that said that women shall experience pain during childbirth. And I'm wondering that because in Revelation chapter 12, it states that in a retelling of it, she screamed out in birth pangs. So it kind of implies that she was not free from original sin.
Okay. That's Nate, this is something that the church fathers took up, talked about. The church fathers were under the general agreement that Mary did not suffer pain in childbirth because she was preserved from the stain of original sin. That's the Immaculate Conception. She was preserved from the stain of original sin. One of the stains of original sin is generally understood to be pain during childbirth. Now, one thing I would mention that is sometimes brought up is that Mary, if we go back and we look in Genesis after the fall, what God says to Eve, he says that he will greatly increase her pain in childbirth, increase woman's pain in childbirth. So if you examine that text, it appears as it could be understood in such a way that there was pain in childbirth before the fall, and that it just that pain was exaggerated then after the fall. And Mary then was free from that exaggerated pain, the extra pain, the increase in pain that is a result of the fall, but she would still have been subject to the ordinary pain of childbirth that came even before the fall. So that's another possibility here. Sometimes when scholars look at the woman in in Revelation who does scream out in pain in childbirth, and try to reconcile that with what the church fathers believed. It is possible also that Mary, being completely a woman, she was still fully human. She's not divine like Jesus, although she was preserved from original sin, that maybe Mary wanted to experience the fullness of childbirth as other women do. It could be that Mary chose to go through that. And on the other end of Mary's life, at the end of Mary's life, we don't know whether or not she died. So somewhat analogous to this whole thing is that while the church teaches that at the end of Mary's earthly life, she was taken up into heaven, theologians are divided on the issue of whether she died or not. Some will say, well, she was not subject to the stain of original sin, which would seem to include human death as well. But then others will say that, well, even her own son, Jesus, experienced death. Mary may have chosen to go ahead and experience death herself. So this is something that we can speculate on. And Nate, I think as far as the final conclusion on Mary and experiencing pain during childbirth, you know, you might want to read for yourself a lot that had been written on this. Tim Staples will be on next hour, and he has written extensively on this. You know, you might even talk to him next hour or read some of his materials. He has a book, a couple of different books on Mary, where he goes into details on these things. Okay, Nate?
Oh, may I just ask why the church fathers would think that such an act would not cause pain, you know, what the physics of it, and why you might think that pain might be somewhat exaggerated in your theory. It seems like a very normal amount of pain for the process that's going on, not an exaggerated amount of pain. If you look at what's happening, the amount of stretching, then how could you say that might be exaggerated in today's women?
Yeah, and you know that's something. If we're getting into the physiological, scientific, medical explanations for this, how might that have changed from before the fall to after the fall? I don't know. Again, we could speculate on that. You know, maybe prior to the fall, God preserved this pain or kept the pain to a minimum, and he chose not to do that then after the fall. Maybe there was a special grace God provided. I don't know. I'm just throwing out an idea, Nate. But what Genesis says is that God will increase pain in childbirth. He doesn't say he will institute pain in childbirth. So I think there probably was. I think you could argue that there was pain in childbirth prior to the fall. But that somehow, we're not told how, but somehow that pain was increased after childbirth or after the fall. And then how Mary, let's say that there was some pain prior to childbirth, prior to the fall, how could she give birth without it? The church fathers describe it as though, you know, light going through a window pane, that, you know, maybe possibly even Jesus wasn't born in the ordinary physical way, that there was at one point he was still in the womb, and at the next point he came out of the womb as light through a pane of glass, with keeping Mary completely intact with no pain whatsoever. Again, Nate, you might want to read what some of the church fathers have speculated on this. Bottom line is there's not a definitive teaching of the church on this. So I'd encourage you to read what's out there. If it's a concern or of interest to you, read what's out there, read what the fathers have written, read what Tim Staples has written as he's examined all of this, and then come to your own conclusion. And you know, you can, if you're a Catholic, you be a good Catholic, whichever side of this you come down on. Okay.
Behold Your Mother is the book, the big book from Tim Staples on Mary, and it extensively covered there. Nate, thanks for that call. We go to Mary in Lincoln, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Radio. Mary, you are on with Jim Blackburn.
Oh, thank you. I'm a first-time caller. I was reading Theology for Beginners by Frank Sheed, and in the final chapter of the epilogue, he was talking about how he had examined a great number of lay people in this guild, this Catholic Evidence Guild. And he said that the trainees were asked if God died on the cross and then what happened to the universe while God was dead. And that almost all of them answered the first question, that it wasn't God who died on the cross, but the human nature of Christ. And then he said the answer to what happened to the universe while God was dead was that the second person died on the cross and the other two survived and sustained the universe till his resurrection. But and so these were both false, but he didn't explain, he didn't give the answer, the correct answer, at least not in, you know, in this book. So I was wondering, I just, you know, what the answers to those questions are.
Okay. Well, Mary, I it's been a long time since I've read Theology for Beginners and Theology in Sanity, also written by Frank Sheed, and some of the other just tremendous books by him. But so I can't address what he taught about this specifically, but I can tell you just from a theological perspective, you know, sometimes when we think of God dying and that, you know, Jesus died on the cross and he's God, so God died, that is somehow, so there's some sort of finality to God. And, you know, when we think about God, we should realize God really, he is existence. He is being. He is who is. I mean, as he said to Moses, I am who I am. God is not capable of death, except that as he took on a human nature, the second person of the Trinity took on a human nature. I don't think it's correct to say Jesus, that the God's human nature died on the cross. I think it's appropriate to say that because Jesus is the second person of the Trinity incarnate, that he died. He indeed did die on the cross, and Jesus is God. Now, yes, he's the second person of the Trinity. He's a divine person, and he did have a human nature, did take on human nature. And it was because of that human nature that he took on that he was capable of death. So what happened as far as the universe goes when the second person of the Trinity, when God died on the cross, the universe continued to exist. There was, you know, as you mentioned, the other two persons of the Trinity were still there. Well, the second person of the Trinity was still there too. His body had died. He had died a physical death. But just as you and I, Mary, when we die, our human souls will continue on, will continue to live really in a sense, and we'll be reunited with resurrected bodies at the end of time. This is the teaching of the church. Jesus himself, because he was capable of death, doesn't mean there was some sort of finality to him or finality to the Godhead in general. It's so very interesting question. I wish I could talk more about it, but I do hear the music there. Sai, so I'll turn things back over to you. Thanks for calling, Mary.
Thanks, Mary, and thank you, Jim Blackburn, for being with us today on Catholic Answers Live.
Thanks for having me. God bless you.
And you too. God bless you. And next hour, Tim Staples will be in. It's the same topic, whatever's on your mind, regarding the life of the Catholic Church, the faith of the Catholic Church, the teaching, the history of the Catholic Church. The morals of the Catholic Church, anything. It's open forum. We're happy to take them all. So if you are on the line, stay on the line. And if you haven't gotten on the line yet, now is the time to do that. 888-318-7884 is the number. I am Cy Kellett, your host. We'll be right back with Tim Staples and more open forum on Catholic Answers Live.